This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Listen to us on KPFK, KPFA, and other Pacifica affiliates, and watch us on Free Speech TV Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. Civil rights groups around the U.S. have strongly denounced the decision by President-elect Donald Trump to bring alt-right commentator and writer Steve Bannon into his cabinet. Bannon is the chairman of Breitbart News, a notoriously racist, sexist, and Islamophobic right-wing publication that championed Trump's candidacy for months. Bannon is tipped to be Trump's chief strategist, undermining claims by many in the wake of the election that Trump wouldn't actually realize his most extremist targeting of minorities. My guest is Chip Berlay. He is a journalist and scholar and coordinator of progressivemovements.us. He has been studying right-wing political and social movements for many years. Welcome to the program, Chip.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, where did this term alt-right come from and what does it mean? We've been seeing it for the past many months, and now with Steve Bannon tipped to be entering, you know, this inner circle of the presidency, I think it's more important than ever that we understand this term.
Well, alt-right is a communications channel. It's an alternative sort of posting medium, which has attracted a wide range of people to the section called alt-right. Alt-right is a bunch of different kinds of political and social and economic views, most of which are built around some form of white nationalism, masculinist, and basically xenophobic authoritarianism. So it ranges from kind of conservatives with an attitude out to neo-Nazis.
So let's talk about Steve Bannon himself and exactly who he is and what Breitbart News is. For people who have been following right-wing news, this is a very popular website that probably shows up very often in the feeds of Trump supporters in the lead up to the election, founded by a man named Andrew Breitbart, who died, I believe it was a couple of years ago. Where does Breitbart News figure into the right-wing media landscape?
Well, for many Americans, especially in the heartland, the news sources are silos. They basically are made up of a group of right-wing AM radio, FM radio, online television networks that talk about how white Americans and men and straight people have been displaced by unsavory others. So it's not so much that it's just Breitbart News or Bannon or any of 50 other outlets. It's that there's a pervasive media sweep across the United States where millions of people have heard complaints that Obama was a Muslim, that transgender people are going to rape you in the bathroom when really they want to go to the bathroom, that black people are the new upper class, taking away all the privileges of what really belongs to straight white Christian men. So the focus should be on the fact that since the Reagan administration, this has been built by a group of different sectors of the right, the most militant and xenophobic and bigoted of which are aired on places like Breitbart News. And Bannon is sort of one of the great quote-unquote intellectuals of this movement.
Oh. Well, let's go through the kinds of things that we've seen appearing in Breitbart News. We've collected for our TV audience a number of their headlines, screen grabs from their website that'll give you a sense of the kinds of things that this outlet puts out that we can now expect to infect the White House, if you will. Very strong anti-Muslim sentiments, you know, very, very sort of stereotypical anti-Muslim headlines, anti-woman, especially strongly anti-woman. Chip, yes. One headline from Breitbart News is, the solution to online harassment is simple. Women should log off. That's just a straight up headline. And it has a picture of a crying baby girl on it. Another headline is, birth control makes women unattractive and crazy. Here's another headline from Breitbart News. There's no hiring bias against women in tech. They just suck at interviews. I mean, when I look at this, when I look at these headlines, the first thing that comes to my mind is a very fragile male ego who feels extremely threatened by women simply asking to be equal is putting the stuff out there. Am I wrong?
No, you're right. I mean, obviously for progressives, the solution to places like Breitbart News is cut it off. So, I mean, this is the kind of rhetoric that's been circulating in these subcultures for many years. It goes back to an earlier kind of view of many men, many white men, about the power and privilege that they deserve. So when people talk about, you use the word like extremism or stupid or crazy, these people are seeking revenge. These people are what Gene Hardesty, my mentor, called mobilizing resentment. This is a resentment and revenge movement against people who feel they have been literally emasculated, I wish, at least symbolically, by women who want equal power, and black people who want equal power, and gay people who want equal power. This is essentially a movement of restoring a straight white Christian nation.
Now, on the issue of the LGBTQ community and how this community has been attacked by sites like Breitbart, interestingly enough, Breitbart has employed a very openly gay writer named Milo Yiannopoulos, who is this British writer. You know, he's flamboyant. He'll wear lipstick and paint his nails. He's also extremely anti-woman, and he's been banned from Twitter for being so abusive towards women. He wrote one article called How to Make Women Happy, Uninvent the Washing Machine and the Pill. This really bizarre idea coming from an unlikely source, gay man, openly gay man, who basically thinks women's liberation is the source of women's unhappiness. So how do you reconcile this aspect? Is Breitbart sort of progressive on just gay men?
Well, sure. I mean, there's a long history of dissident political movements from the right adopting a person who is the outlier of the group that they demonize. So, you know, you have black conservatives, you have gay conservatives, you have women conservatives. This is nothing new. It is the exception to the rule. And by embracing these exceptions, they provide a thin veneer of respectability by saying, you know, we don't want to, you know, destroy the ability of gay people to marry or have jobs. Look, we have a gay guy with us. So it's a ruse, essentially, and it works.
Now, if you look at the photograph of the group of writers that Bannon oversees, Bannon's Bulldogs, they're called, they're almost all white men, but there's one black guy, there's two white women. So I think you're right in pointing to those. Just as, say, Trump is able to do by pointing out the group Latinos for Trump, I'm not anti-Latino, he's able to undermine any claims that he's racist. Is that basically it?
That's it. That's how it works. It's very good. And, you know, in a personal face-to-face basis, they treat these people, you know, like they're friends. But everything they're doing is to undermine the ability of these folks to, of the larger group, of this identity structure, to have civil liberties and civil rights and basic human rights.
Now, how close has somebody from this political ideology ever come to the White House before Steve Bannon? Did we see this sort of thing happening, for example, in the Bush administration?
Well, both Bush and Reagan elevated people from the Christian right, obviously. You know, the Surgeon General coup was Reagan's payoff to the Christian right. So this goes on, but nothing of this kind of open demonization and nastiness, except towards gay people. Certainly in the Reagan administration, there were folks who were willing to demonize gay people, but not anything like this level at this higher level. And during a campaign, usually would keep these people sort of behind the curtain. So no,
never chief strategist for the president.
Yes.
Wow. So here's what's concerning. There's been, first of all, this kind of backlash to the fear that people are feeling. Don't freak out. It may not be as bad. Look at Trump's victory speech. It was very reconciliatory and very gracious. And then there's this other sort of side of it that is kind of accepting that Steve Bannon is okay. A lot of people pointing out the NPR, for example, you know, actually interviewing people from Breitbart, normalizing this, and then, you know, others responding with the hashtag not normal. I mean, what should the response to this be? It seems to me like we have every reason to be absolutely petrified. People who believe in progress for, you know, and equality for people of color, for women, just real progress, ought to be extremely petrified. There's nothing normal about Steve Bannon entering the White House.
There's nothing normal about this election. In Europe, you see political opinion columns writing about how America is conciliating with fascism. The proper role for every progressive person and every decent person is to resist in any way possible for you, given if you have family commitments or disabilities or, you know, or can't get around like you used to. Look, there's a way to resist for everybody. But resistance, I believe in nonviolent civil disobedience at this stage. I think people are watching the political establishment in Washington conciliate with groups of people coming into public office who are going to roll back human rights in America all the way back to before the Roosevelt administration. And so I think that there's a kind of ability of the Democrats inside the Beltway to pretend everything's okay, and within especially news organizations like NPR that are beholding on their government, these people would be telling you, don't worry about the Jews, those trains are taking them to day camp.
So are comparisons between Trump and Hitler overblown? There have been anti-Trump rallies in Germany, German progressives saying, we've been here, don't be complacent. You know, I saw one headline from somebody whose family survived Nazi Germany saying, fear of Hitler and screaming about that fear is what saved my family, not kind of giving him a chance. Is it overblown for us to compare the rise of Trump, not just Trump himself individually, but the phenomenon around Trump as being this like hallmark for nascent fascism?
Well, he's more like Mussolini than Hitler, but that's kind of an intellectual, you know, fine point. Look, here's how it works. When large groups of people fear they are downwardly mobile or are in fact downwardly mobile, you get something called right-wing populism. And I co-wrote with Matthew N. Lyons a book like in the year 2000, predicting essentially that there would be something like Trump and the Tea Party and the militias we were covering back then were going to morph into something more mainstream. Right-wing populism is the precursor to fascism. Most right-wing populist movements don't become full-blown fascist, and most fascist movements don't take state power. But along the way, many people get hurt and even killed. So the comparison is, if it's made carefully, is completely appropriate.
Now, the right is not homogeneous, obviously. There are many sort of differences. There's even some sort of internecine fighting that goes on between various right-wing formations. On the one hand, you have somebody like Steve Bannon being elevated into this position as White House chief strategist. Then on the other hand, you have groups like the KKK that have a long history in the U.S., and Trump has sort of tried to distance himself from them, but the KKK KKK, but not strongly enough. And the KKK, there are reports that the chapter in North Carolina is going to hold a victory parade out in the open. So how does the KKK figure into the Trump presidency? Is he just going to kind of, you think, pretend that they aren't around while not taking strong enough actions to denounce them?
Well, he'll probably even denounce them. You have to see the political system as not sort of one big circle blob, but across from you have the Republican Party, and then you have the right-wing populist movement that helped elect Trump, and then you have the insurgent ultra-right, which is openly and nakedly supremacist. And I'm sorry, what you have then is this dynamic where the Republican Party, when there is a very large right-wing populist movement, like there has been several times, the Republican Party moves to the right. But at the same time, you have the insurgent ultra-right, which is trying to recruit the right-wing populist movement into open kind of violence and intimidation. And all of these things will be happening over the next few months. And so I have no doubt that Trump will denounce the Klan and the Nazis. But the fact is, there's a dynamic going on where Trump being in the White House will enable and embolden white supremacy, as well as all the other kind of supremacist movements, masculinist movements, anti-feminist movements, anti-gay movements, anti-immigrant movements, anti-Muslim movements, and even anti-Semitism, which is always lurking in the background of the kinds of conspiracy theories that Trump and his followers are spreading.
Let's talk about anti-Semitism. I think it's very, very important here. And it's an interesting point. The Breitbart has been marked as having put out anti-Semitic headlines. There was one in particular about Bill Kristol. It's called Bill Kristol, Republican Spoiler, Renegade Jew. They've been making efforts to, because of course the right wing has had a relationship with the State of Israel. There is a news headline on Breitbart's site right now attempting to recast Steve Bannon as a friend of Israel. You know, friend of the Jewish people, defender of Israel is the title headline of this article. So which is it? Is Breitbart anti-Semitic or is it and anti-Semitic but pro-Israel? I mean, how does that work?
Well, it's a geopolitical analysis versus a conspiracy theory about perfidious Jews. You can be both. You can be supporting Israel as a U.S. ally in the Middle East while hoping that, you know, Jews are repressed in the United States. It's a very complicated time. These things are not contradictory in the slightest. There is a thing called philo-Semitism, where you really appreciate that the Jews are stopping communist, you know, ISIS and totalitarian movements. But at the same time, remember, a lot of the people in the Christian right believe that Israel needs to be held by the Jews so that Jesus can come back and slaughter them and kill all but 144,000 who convert at the last minute. That's what about 10 or 15% of the U.S. population believes, that when Jesus returns, any day now apparently, that the Jews will be destroyed for the most part. They will be wiped off the face of the earth. So on a geopolitical level, you need the Jews in holding Jerusalem. But when Christ returns, we'll just kill them all.
Wow.
So, you know, this stuff is nothing new. I mean, folks have been writing about this since the late 1970s. And whenever you talk to a reporter about it, they go, oh, you're overwrought. You're hand wringing. This can't be really true. These people don't really believe these things. But I spent 40 years interviewing these people, sometimes in their living rooms. And they're very nice, except for the fact that they want to kill all the blacks or kill all the Jews or kill all the gay people. And then they serve you a cup of tea and a cookie.
Wow. What about Breitbart in particular? Has it shown anti-Semitic strains that are, you know, pretty strong? I mean, the Bill Kristol article, you know, I can see someone arguing, well, that's not anti-Semitic to call him a renegade Jew.
Well, it's certainly on the line, but in concert with the other things that he's said, and then you have Trump talking about the international banks. These are dog whistles for anti-Semites to say, oh, these are people who are going to clean house. So do I think Breitbart has used rhetoric that is rooted in anti-Semitism? Yes. Do I think Trump has? Yes. And this is nothing new, again, in sectors of the right, where there's this belief that not only is it the Jews, but it's the liberals and the Democrats and, you know, all of the leftist organizers. There's this idea that there's this elite conspiracy of Jewish banks and powerful figures up above. And then there's the lazy, sinful and subversive folks down below. And that would be union organizers and feminist organizers and gay organizers and people of, basically who are the enemy of the common people.
So what about, finally, what about the fact that you do have certain figures in government that are very forcefully speaking out? I'm thinking of Bernie Sanders. I'm thinking of Elizabeth Warren. Warren put out a very powerful post on her Facebook page where she just called out Steve Bannon website, you know, as heading a website that regularly publishes racist, sexist, bigoted ideas and articles with headlines. And she quotes those headlines and she says the president of the United States should condemn bigots, not give them a West Wing office and empower them to make decisions about the future of our country. I mean, she is very unequivocally saying this is not normal. But I'm seeing, you know, maybe a few other people. Harry Reid has spoken out, Kamala Harris and Bernie Sanders, but not, you know, not nearly enough. You know, and what about members of the Republican Party who were shocked by what Trump was saying? Where are they now?
Well, they're on thin ice. All of us are on thin ice. This is a time to make some decisions about what you're willing to risk to stop this. I was in college in the 1970s when Kent State happened, and the next year, my mentor at the University of Denver was Dean John Rice, Condoleezza Rice's dad, who was in fact a radical civil rights activist, contrary to her claims. And we asked him as a student body to give a speech about the killings at Kent State and Jackson State. And he gave a speech that he said powerful things, one of which was, what will you tell your children when they ask what you did at this moment? What did you do to stop the war? And so I will say, what are you going to do to stop this trend towards fascism and neo-fascism and oppression and repression? And my question is, what are you going to tell your children when they ask you what you did? And after Dean Rice's speech back in the 70s, the next day I went out and committed civil disobedience against the war in Vietnam. I think nonviolent civil disobedience is the starting point for our campaign to turn this around.
Well, Chip, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and spending this time with us. I appreciate all the work that you've done over the years. Thanks so much.
Thanks. You too. Back at you. Stay strong.
You too. Chip Berlet is my guest. He's a journalist and scholar. He is the coordinator of progressivemovements.us. He studied right-wing political and social movements for many years. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Twitter at twitter.com/ruwithsonali.